Welcome to another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler. My guest on today's podcast is my friend Jake Watts. Welcome, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Jake is someone I've known for about 20 years. When my wife and I moved in the Cottonwood area, Jake was going to Cottonwood High School, and I think that's when I first met you and your family, and that was like 28 years ago when you were a high school age man. And before we moved into this ward, we were in the ward of your wife Sandy. So we got to know your wife, Chelsea Williams, who is now Chelsea Williams Watts. So between my wife and I, we feel like we know both of you. And when you got together, we were really happy about that, Jake.
Me too.
And now you have two children. So welcome to the podcast. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Jake. I've kind of given a little bit of an introduction, where you grew up and your career and some of your, and just as an introduction, we're going to talk about faith journeys tonight. Both Jake and I are active members of the church, but both of us have had kind of a faith journey and have walked a road where our faith evolved a little bit, and we both have been able to stay committed members. But we want to share, in particular, Jake, share his framework for how he believes and how he worked through his faith. And we hope this is helpful to listeners trying to figure out a way to process their faith and stay in our church, and also others that are trying to help others that may be struggling. So Jake has great insights. I've had lunch with him and have visited with him and have heard his journey and just felt impressed. It'd be great to have Jake share his story for our listeners. So anyway, go ahead and just tell us more about yourself, Jake.
Sure, yeah. I like you said, I grew up here in Salt Lake City. I went to Cottonwood High School, played sports there.
I remember those days. We were better back then, Jake.
It wasn't a result of me, but I enjoyed you know, growing up in here in Salt Lake. I served my mission in Indianapolis Mission, and had the opportunity to really spend, as you know, I tell people, I wish I would have served a foreign mission, but I tell people that I really had the opportunity to learn the gospel in those years, spending maybe 2 or 3 hours a day just reading the scriptures. And I did get into a little, you know, it wasn't, I don't think the rules were where you had to only focus on the standard works at that time. So I got to read a little bit more broadly.
Good.
And I really, my love of the gospel and the Savior and books and literature in general kind of stems from that time. My mission was a watershed moment of my life and really changed me into the person I am today. And so after my mission, shortly after my mission, I went to university at Columbia University in New York, where I studied philosophy and economics.
Yeah. That is cool.
So, you know, I had courses on everything from Aristotle to political philosophy, and I actually had a class, love in the Renaissance, and so anyway.
That's cool.
Not very applicable to making money, but very interesting to me. So went to Columbia, came back by way of just kind of a fluke to stay in Salt Lake, and ended up getting a job with an advertising agency. I'd worked in marketing all growing up. I have some family that's in the advertising industry, and met my wife 6 weeks after I moved back. I had no intention of moving back to Salt Lake. I loved New York City. I was looking for jobs in Boston and in DC and New York, and we met, and 6 months later we ended up getting married, and thank my lucky stars for coming back to Salt Lake.
We were sure excited when both of you, we heard you were dating, and we just thought the world of both of you, and to hear you guys were getting dating just was great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's the highlight of my life, and just so grateful for a wonderful wife and family. So after we were here for a couple of years, I went to graduate school in marketing at Northwestern University. And after that, went and spent in the healthcare industry. I went and worked for a company named Baxter Healthcare. And they sent us over to Asia for 5 years. So I lived for 5 years in Asia, 3 years in Shanghai, and nearly 2 years in Singapore. But I spent most of my waking hours in Indonesia. So I got to see a lot of Asia, a lot of the world, And, you know, that's back here in Salt Lake now, working for a big med tech company. And, you know, just grateful for the journey, grateful that God has taken me to many places and kind of helped me shape a story I never thought possible. And just immensely grateful and feel incredibly blessed to be and fortunate to be where I am right now.
And I've loved seeing your young family pics on in social media. Chelsea often has just wonderful pics on Instagram of your young family, and particularly Singapore is what I remembered. I always imagined, you know, we raised our kids in Utah. What would it be like to raise our kids in Singapore and Asia? And any thoughts on that, on how that experience was for you, and if you hope to go back to Europe?
Absolutely hope to go
or
back.
Or Asia.
Absolutely hope to go back. Trying to aim that direction. You know, raising children and raising yourself in many ways in a foreign country is such a life-changing thing. I think you know, people have asked me, you know, because I've said many times, I want to go back. And many people have asked me, well, why do you want to do that? So comfortable to be in the States. And I said, look, when you grow, where you are, living where you grew up or in the country where you grew up, you know all the inside jokes, you know the language. You can hear people without listening to them. There's so many things that you get. But when you live in a foreign country among people whose history could not be more different than your own, you're learning something every day. It's uncomfortable. You're learning language. You're learning history, culture. You're trying to make sense of the world. And in doing that, it's so difficult that you learn a lot about yourself. You grow up. You see the world in a more nuanced way. And you also, if for me at least, you come to love the world and people. And you see, for me at least, you see that God is far bigger and far more in things than you ever thought with your own kind of provincial point of view. And so, yeah, it just has changed my heart in many ways. And you know, there's of course the work aspect to it, but honestly, what it does to you as a person is the most powerful thing. And what it does for your family in terms of their worldview and their compassion and appreciation is just something that it's hard to get from going on a 1 week excursion somewhere.
Do your kids talk about Singapore?
Oh yeah, they say they miss it. They want to go back. My daughter's fluent Mandarin, so she.
That's cool.
My son was born in Shanghai, and they just have a connection to it. You know, my son says he's Chinese. He doesn't quite get how it works, but you know, there's still that connection and that draw.
That's really cool. What a wonderful experience for your family.
Yeah.
Talk about your faith. Has your faith been consistent in our church? Or has it evolved and changed over time?
So, you know, it's tough to talk about one's faith journey because I think it's narrating one's past is always complicated. And this is where I get a bit philosophical, right? Because I think you narrate it from where you are now. And you know, with that kind of introduction, I'll be plain about it. So I grew up in the church in an amazing, loving, incredibly faithful family. My ancestors, more or less, are, you know, pioneers, and my grandfather on my father's side is a convert from Australia.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I grew up with. Not only I grew up with one side of saying, hey, we our ancestors knew, you know, the prophet, and my great grandfather was assistant to the Quorum of the 12 and secretary to 5 prophets and a general and the oldest living general authority. And then my grandfather was a convert on my dad's side. And so I grew up with a history of faith, and that's important. I mean, it's important to have that grounding, foundation. And so I had that all growing up, but as many people do, they take it for granted. It's not until you're where I'm at that you realize how important that those narrative threads are in helping you keep your faith together and kind of tying back to those who have come before. I realize that now, but in growing up, of course, like everyone, take it for granted. And so, you know, I of course, like any teenager, made choices that were, you know, less than optimal. Maybe some more than others, but, you know, I had a deeply spiritual experience when I was about 17 years old after, you know, not making the best of choices. I had an evening where I came home. I didn't read anything, let alone scriptures growing up very much. So I had an evening when I came home and very late from doing things I probably shouldn't have done. And I, for some reason, went over to my desk, and my scriptures are there. And I for some reason opened them, and on it opened to Mosiah 14. And if you remember Mosiah 14, it's Benjamin King, or excuse me, Abinadi, speaking to King Noah and his priests. But he's reciting Isaiah, and he's talking about how, you know, Christ was you know, bruised for our iniquities, you know, man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And I had it was kind of an earthquake experience for me. Cool. And I just got on my knees and I said, God, please save me, help me. And I've only had a couple experiences since then where I've really felt, you know, the love of God kind of completely envelop my being. And that changed me to really be aiming towards something better and higher, which got me, you know, to the mission. So then beyond that, of course, then I come back and had a fantastic mission and end up, you know, going to school in New York. And you can't, I think it was Francis Bacon who talked about, you know, a little philosophy inclineth to atheism, but once you kind of, but really understanding philosophy, and I'm of course paraphrasing him, you know, brings one to God. And I had that period where that little bit really, it combined with, you know, some really difficult personal and family experiences back home, really kind of shook me off that foundation that I had. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all know what it's like to encounter new ideas, to experience, you know, it wasn't that I did grow up in Salt Lake and I did grow up in a bit of a bubble, right? Good and bad. And having people and experiences kind of pierce that in some ways really shook me, right? And I think everyone can really resonate with that, that moment when you feel completely unmoored, right? You feel completely...
I love that term, Jake, unmoored.
You don't know...
Powerful visual.
You kind of lose a sense of what's up and down, and you feel unmoored. I mean, I guess for a lack of a better way of saying it. And at that point, there's a huge... emotional need to leap to certainty, to leap back to rootedness and groundedness. And for me, at least, that kind of 3.5 years where I had a lot of, you know, I had the intellectual, the emotional, the kind of personal, all kind of colliding in ways that were incredibly challenging. I went through a lot of doubt, a lot of confusion, a lot of fear. It was incredibly challenging, right? And you know, we can talk more about kind of how I persisted through that and what allowed me to kind of remain, right? And not just say, look, you know, everything's uncertain. I need to find certainty somewhere else, or things aren't what I was taught, and therefore they're wrong or inaccurate. And, you know, life didn't turn out the way I thought it was, or I was promised it was going to be. And therefore I've been duped. You know, every person has these experiences, right? They're so common. But I think what I found was that I had to really go deep down and ask the question, who do I want to be? And there's a lot of people who will tell you who you should be.
That's interesting.
There's not a lack of people telling you who you are, who you should be, who you should follow. But I truly believe that you can only find that in a deep dialogue, soul to soul, between you and your maker. And I know that that's hard when sometimes you can say, is God there? Does God exist? And I know that that's, trust me, I know how difficult that is. But I know that it's possible. So anyway, we can revisit that. But I had a very long stretch of these kind of dark nights of the soul.
And dark nights of the soul.
Yeah.
Very powerful visual.
And look, I mean, these dark nights still come, right? And I think that's one of the other points that you and I have talked about, is that one, these things are common, and it's not a commentary. It's not a commentary on a person's spirituality. It's not a commentary on their worthiness. The dark night is, in my opinion, if you're trying to do what's right, a dark night is a spur to find something deeper in yourself. So anyway, like I said, these things persist, of course. And, you know, that kind of 3 years of challenges, you know, the morning came after the dark night, of course. And
did you doubt your belief in God?
And yes, of course.
I mean, so did everything sort of, not only the church, but your belief in God.
Yeah, like we've talked about, I think we grow up in a beautiful faith, right? And that has a premium on certainty. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you live long enough and you experience enough faiths, as I have, you know, I spent a lot of time in Indonesia with some amazing Muslim friends whose faith I deeply respect. I have many Hindu friends, and, you know, and I have friends who are atheists. And I think everyone in every faith has these challenges, these doubts, these questions. Is God there? You don't live long enough. You know, if you're staying in this world and you're staying engaged in this world, you don't, it's not long before you ask these questions. When you see injustices and troubles and you have your own experiences. And so, yes, absolutely. I had those doubts. I wondered, you know, is God there? Does he hear me? Am I who I was taught that I was?
It's really honest.
Yeah, and now, years down the road, it's for me, if someone, you know, I hear someone asking those same questions, for me, that is, to me, that's a hopeful thing, because I know that they've reached a point where they're getting serious about what it means to be a human being, what it means to, you know, in the gospel context, what it means to be a committed disciple, what it means to be, I mean, they're getting to the bedrock of the human experience, right? And so to me, when people ask those questions, it's, I know they're serious.
I've never heard anybody describe the, I think it was the darkness of night, in such a positive, hopeful way, Jake, because those words sound so dark and hopeless and difficult, but I love the way you've said, no, that's not. That's actually a very hopeful place to be in, that you can work through that in a positive way.
Yeah. Look, it's, again, we talk about narrative and hindsight. If you would have asked me in the middle of those things, in these struggles, whether or not it was a positive thing, whether I could have, you know, repositioned it into a way of engaging with engaging with my purpose, engaging with the true meaning of my life, I might have had a bit of a different answer.
Right. Right.
But that's an interesting point though, right? Is that, and I just finished reading, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning again. And I know it's a quite common book that people read, but one of the points that he makes is that those that endured through the Holocaust experience had a purpose. They had a vision of who they were going to be when they got out of that experience. Now, obviously, sadly, many, many did not. Mm-hmm. But his point psychologically was that you have to, in these dark nights, you have to go down and you have to find a purpose and a meaning of your existence. And he makes the point that life asks us to find that point. It doesn't give us that point. We have to go and craft our story into who we want to become. And to me, in a retrospect, that was one of the things that helped me to persist through those challenges, was a very simple question: who do I want to be? And a vision down the future, in the future, of who I hoped to be. And that kind of helped me to, you know, endure the hourly battles of fear and doubt and worry and anxiety that were surely there.
Would you label this experience as a faith crisis, a faith journey, a faith in a falling? Some people talk this isn't falling backwards, it's actually falling upwards in you. And they don't talk about, even though those terms sound like a step backwards, it's actually a step forward. So any thoughts on how you name this experience?
I mean, it's all the above, right? When you're going through doubts, right? And I realize that my experience is not everyone's experience. You know, I am fortunate to have had the experiences I've had. And so maybe I dealt with my faith crisis plus journey plus... whatever you want to call it, in maybe a different way than someone else would, right? But look, I think to your point around it being a step forward, my sense is that that choice is yours. The choice to say, how do I engage with the complexity of problems, whether it's, you know, historical church things, whether it's this sheer, you know, the injustice of the world, the problem of evil, whether it's, you know, something terrible has happened to you. I mean, there's a wide spectrum of things that push someone in the direction of saying, honestly, is this all there is? Like, come on, this, you know, God exists. You got to be kidding me. These things are happening, or I felt like I was lied to, and everything kind of crumbles. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like even in the midst of, for most cases, I will say, even in the midst of those things, you still have a choice of how you will engage that struggle, right? And it is a struggle. Let's just be honest. Let's not be, you know, super positive and optimistic. This is a battle for your soul, of who you are going to be, of what the monument of your existence is. This is a struggle, and it's not a struggle, a one-time struggle. This is a struggle that goes on, and we should treat it as such. We should respect it as such, right? This is something that we should respect. But I do believe at the bottom, there is still the freedom of our being to choose, right? And so, to your point, we can choose to make, we can make this thing, this faith challenge, this crisis, whatever you want to call it, this journey, it is a journey, and we can choose to engage with it, you know, honorably, in a way that truly engages the purpose of our lives and the meaning of who we want to be.
Were you doing this alone, Jake, or did you involve church leaders, family, friends? What was helpful for you, or is this kind of you working with God to wrestle and kind of figure this out?
All the above. It can be, you know, at that time, which is maybe when it really kind of the heart of things, or when the, you know, really the bulk of it came at me. My sense is it was still pretty kind of shameful to be like,
talk to people about how you felt.
Hey, Bishop, so not sure if life has any meaning. That can be a little shocking. There's shame there. But I think what I found, well, and I don't know that that's necessary. I hope that that's not the case now. If it is, we should abolish the shame behind people being afraid, people being doubtful, people having faith crises. I think we should take it as opportunity to really put our arms around people, right? And that's what happened to me, right? And I think maybe just organically was I found a couple mentors who had been down the road a little further than I had, who kind of took me in and said, look, you're not alone. This type of experience is as old as our church, certainly, as old as Christianity. I mean, not that Doubting Thomas was in a faith crisis, but he surely was. Says, show me or I'll, unless I put my finger in Christ's eyes, not going to believe. And like I said earlier, this is a theme in other faiths. It's as
I
old
like
as
that. That's de-shaming in a way, because you're normalizing this can happen to very faithful people.
It can. And I think in many ways it's all the more poignant to the most faithful. I feel like this comes to the most faithful in many ways.
Very cool.
Not that I'm saying, hey, if you have doubts, this is a sign that you're super faithful and righteous. It may be, but this whole shame and the nervousness and the worry about sharing, I think there's a lot bigger community now. People are saying, look, we understand there's challenges and difficulties. They're very real. We get that, right? We also get that for some, those challenges are such where they can no longer engage. We understand that. But for those with the desire to believe, there's space, there's people who are willing even to put their arms around you to say, we've been there, we've done that. Here's how you can engage. It's okay to be unmoored. It's okay to not know. It's okay just to have the desire to believe, right? Even if it's the desire, right? We're going back to Alma 32. So I found mentors. I found friends. I found people who had been down that road. I was lucky to do that. Of course, then beyond that, I did my own work. And I think at the end of the day, that might be the difference between the difference between in my story in many ways was, yes, it was the friends, yes, it was the mentors, but back to the point, I had to go and say, is this, let me excavate this whole thing for myself and really get down to the core and say, man, I taught people this stuff on my mission. I prayed my whole life. I've seen things, I've felt things, I've experienced things, and really kind of excavate all that and get to a point deep in my soul where I could find some toehold, just maybe even a pinky hold, to be able to stay there, to then get the hand and the arm, and then get and kind of get back, right? But it's a struggle, and we should respect that. I'm not saying we should celebrate it by no means. You know, should we encourage people to go out and, you know, be skeptics? Again, I study philosophy, so that is encouraged there. But what I'm saying is, we should be true and honest that, or be truthful that we have a narrative in our history of someone saying, I'm not sure that what I'm being taught is true. I'm going to go find out for myself. And that's what we should be celebrating, is that questing spirit, that desire to truly know. We should be celebrating that.
Thanks for just telling your story, Jake, and being so honest. It's very, very helpful for our listeners and for me personally. How did you find mentors? If there's listeners thinking, I want to find people like Jake is talking about, but I'm uncomfortable opening up,
yeah,
because there's so much shame around this topic. Any advice for people in that area?
I sometimes feel like, if you're in your ward, you can kind of spot people. You kind of...
Do they wear bow ties and blue shirts?
Bow ties, Jake? Blue shirts, suspenders.
Suspenders.
Suspenders will kind of, you know, give them away. So beyond kind of filling people out in your ward, you know, my hope is that, and I've had fantastic bishops. You know, I've served in bishoprics. You know, I've been in the elders' quorum, president, young men's president, high priest, all those things, right? And I think that my sense, and maybe this is just speaking for myself, is that I feel like people now, leaders, men and women, are okay to hear these things. Now, I may be too positive about that. But I don't know. And so they may be open to hearing, and therefore like also know an adult or someone who's further down the road who is a bit more of a questing spirit, or a bit more open and a bit more, there's that crazy guy, you know, Brother Johnson or whatever. He, you know, he's read everything. So there's that. Look, there are so many resources online. There are so many good people who are engaging the faith in a thoughtful way. I mean, there's so many websites, podcasts like yours and others. People who are just solid people who are trying to find a way to engage with the difficulties of life in the gospel and stay true to what they've felt in their soul. And so I don't have any like particular recommendations of people, but I think, I don't know. I'm happy to try to find someone for somebody to pass on to or speak to myself. But I
do like the idea that you needed people to talk to about this. And I think obviously there's people outside of the church that will talk about this stuff, and there's online communities, but it seems like you found people in the church or people wanting to sort of that knew all the stuff and also found a way to stay. And it seems like those are the, and it's harder to find people like that sometimes.
It is hard.
So it seems like that's a good formula for all of us.
Yeah. Look, there's no shame in asking for help. This is something that I've learned over time. You just kind of learn by by fits and starts, and that you should be asking people for help and not feel bad about it.
Talk about if there's bishops. It sounds like you've had good bishops, and if our listeners are local leaders or parents wanting to do the right thing when someone talks about doubts or concerns or their faith, what advice for them that would be helpful based on your own experience?
I know it's a scary thing because, so first let me just acknowledge that, you know, I've been incredibly positive about, because from my own experience about faith challenges, but I do recognize that for other people, it's not a positive thing when someone comes to them and says, I don't believe, or I've read such and such, or I heard this about our history, or whatever the case may be, or I'm not comfortable with some of the policies or things like that. Because I think our natural reaction is, you know, we're a very, tribe's not the right word. I mean, we're a people, right? We're a group of very committed. I mean, it is in our DNA. And so if someone comes and says, I'm not quite sure that this is all it's cracked up to be, the natural reaction is a defensive one. And to me, that initial, and there might be good reasons for that, because you're being, you know, in some ways, people who are having struggles are really afraid. And so they want to share that, and they kind of can, that can be contagious, and they can scare other people, right? But for leaders, I think the first thing is to say, let me just listen to you. Let's not like be judgmental. Let's not shame people. Let's not assume that they're, you know, doing something wrong with their boyfriend or girlfriend. Like, let's not go there. Let's be confident in the faith that we have. Let's treat them as individuals who are having a human experience, a spiritual experience, and listen to them. Let's listen to them first. Let's, you know, and whatever the case may be, let's be with them as human beings, soul to soul. Let's stay in that spot until they can feel like that they trust us. Because in many cases, they may have lost their trust. So how do we build the trust and the love back?
The link between
before we get into like, before we get into the nuances, let's establish trust and love and common ground and be with people before we kind of like, you know, marshal the troops and try to like pick off every, you know, point of doctrine that maybe someone is worried about and concerned about, and maybe rightly so.
I love the link you just made between listening and trust. Mm. And I guess the question before that would, how would you build trust in a relationship discussing this? And I think you just shared a really key pillar of that is listening. And then how important trust would be, so then you can be open and vulnerable and feel like there's trust there.
You know, I think I heard you say there's a difference between belonging and fitting in.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think sometimes when these conversations happen, it's like, oh no, you're the like square peg in the round hole. How do we like chop off the edges or whatever, round you out or whatever it may be to get you back to where we thought you were? But to me, it's more about how do we immediately, when that happens, establish belonging. You belong to us. You know, you, if you're a faithful member, or if you're, you know, if you have pioneer ancestors, you know, you have this in your DNA, and how, you belong here. How do we help you belong? How do we create space for you to be able to be who you are and to be able to engage in this wrestle with God, right? And wrestle with yourself.
I love that answer. A question just came to my mind that we have never talked about is, how do you, now as a father of young kids, you have You're not raising college-age kids, obviously. You're 38. Someday they'll be college-age kids, and someday they'll be your age mm-hmm. when you went through this. Is there mm-hmm. things, as I'm sure you're thinking, what am I going to do to help my prepare my kids so that they'll have the tools in place to be able to, I don't know, weather the storm sounds too negative, but just navigate this. What, any thoughts? Because I'm sure you're thinking about how to raise your kids and mm-hmm. give them the tools and also mm-hmm. maybe eventually teach you more about some of the complicated parts of our church.
So we're already addressing complicated stuff.
Cool. And remind our listeners
I have a 7-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old boy. You know, we're already saying, you know, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young had more than one wife. I mean, and that's that situation, you know, those things are part of our history. And I think we owe it to our children, certainly, and to those that we go to church with to discuss those things, right? As maybe potentially embarrassing or difficult as it may be. So part of that is just being open and honest from the get-go about some of these things. You know, my daughter asks, you know, why can't girls pass the sacrament? And she asked that when she's 5 years old. And so, and that's not an easy thing. You know, I would love to see, you know, women have a lot more, a lot stronger leadership presence. Look, the women who lead Relief Society and Young Women's my wife is a primary president. Those are very difficult jobs. Those are leadership positions. There's no doubt about that. But I think we owe it to our daughters and to the women in our lives to really elevate their leadership and their capacity. And so
I love that.
We address it now. That's part of, I think, some of the issues we've gotten into is that we didn't just kind of talk about it, right? It's hard to communicate difficult things. I mean, I read this book, Crucial Conversations, not too long ago. It is a human problem to like address messy things. And so the earlier, the better is one thing. I think, so that's what I'm doing with my children. The other thing is by example. And this goes to our earlier point around how do leaders engage stuff is that our example means everything. So if we are found being serious about the faith, understanding the challenges, engaging with people who are struggling, doing the hard work of a disciple, of really being among the people who are struggling. You know, I'm just reading starting the New Testament now because we're going to be getting into it. Is Jesus was never doing, he was always doing the dirty work, for lack of a better way of saying it. He wasn't just with the people that were always, of course, these are the disciples with who were the believers. But he spent his time among those for whom faith challenge, crises, difficult pain was their daily, hourly experience. And so I think we need to be really embodying, you know, our faith in that way and being among people, being the example, showing our children, those that we know that we're serious about engaging with these problems, these challenges. Otherwise, it's going to come off as a bit fake when the challenges come. So when my daughter, you know, becomes a college age, if she hasn't seen me kind of engaging this stuff from day one, it's going to come off as pretty weird to her when I sit her down and say, oh, by the way, I want to have a conversation about this and you're 18 years old. So anyway, this is my experience.
That's really cool. We've never talked about this kind of stuff on a podcast, and I bet there's a lot of parents of young families that are wanting to do perhaps better than their generation mm-hmm. did, even though their generation probably did the best they could, but we know we can do better. What did you say to your daughter when she asked, why can't girls pass the sacrament?
You know, it's a really hard thing. You know, I get kind of emotional about it because I think that, you know, any...
Now you've got me emotional.
Yeah. You know, any father, any loving parent wants for their child to be able to experience the best and the highest in themselves, be able to do God's work as they see it, and belong and lead, right, in the way that, that Christ showed us. And so, honestly, I have a very hard time answering that question to her. My honest response to her was, this is how it is for now, and but there's opportunities for you, and there will be opportunities for you to be a leader, to do God's work, to, you know, follow in the footsteps of the Savior, and we need to keep praying to God that he can help his daughters lead.
What a great answer.
It's
how did she take that answer?
You know, she's five. No, so she went back to coloring or something like that. So, but it's a real challenge for many people. For some people it is not. And I am sympathetic that with everyone in terms of how they perceive things, right? But I don't know that. I think one of the calls for us as disciples or aspiring disciples is to try to put ourselves in other people's shoes and how they might feel. I mean, it's kind of a common thing to say that. But nowadays it seems a bit radical to step out and say, you know, how might someone else be experiencing the world? And I think Jesus is our exemplar in that case.
How did you learn women's voices in our church, and somehow that, and how that road can be harder?
Oh man, I through my wife, I think surprisingly through my work. I know this sounds weird to say that, but I had two Chinese women bosses. And fantastic leaders, and honestly, I never thought twice about it. Occurred to me. Oh, this is it. It struck me as natural, So I think some of that contrast.
Were you ever threatened by that, or were you just
not at all? I don't know. I didn't find it threatening. I don't.
That's cool.
I know that that's not the case for everyone, right? But I just personally, I like, I'm a learner, and I'm also very interested in kind of new experiences. So I take things as kind of a learning opportunity. And so the kind of that contrast, you know, corporate world leadership of women, and, you know, seeing a bit of a contrast where, you know, most of the administration of the church is done by men. Besides, you know, obviously, of course, we all know the amazing ways that women lead in Relief Society and primary and young women's. There's no doubt about that. But seeing the opportunity that maybe a bit of the contrast in that, man, we have so many strong women. How come we're not hearing from them more often? You know, one of the things I always say is, you know, why are women always speaking second to last? Like as if, you know, the man has to back clean up or something like that. These kind of things that are definitely not doctrinal. These are things that I think are very, you know, Nyland McBain has this fantastic book, Women in Church, where it really just says, here's some common sense things we can do to really elevate women's voices and leadership. And I think we all benefit from that. So it's just kind of my life experience plus the influence of my wife. I have a very strong mother. I have my grandmother was, you know, a very strong woman. And, you know, having these strong women in my life and encountering it in the corporate workplace has made me think, man, we really need to benefit from these women who in many instances are far better leaders than what we see.
I love that, Jake, and my wife and I agree with you about your mom. We're honored to know her and have known her for a long time.
Yeah.
And she is a strong, wonderful woman. I'm still kind of thinking about what you're doing as parents to raise these kids. And and just the very simple thing when you introduce polygamy in a very non-threatening, I mean, I would assume that conversation was very natural and your kids just went back to coloring and they just learned that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young had more than one wife. And it's something they just kind of locked in their brain, and it gives them a foundation then to circle back with you as parents. And you've created safety that you're talking about things in advance that your kids are going to be hearing later. And in my mind, that increases the likelihood they're going to circle back to you and say, Dad, Mom, help me more.
Yeah.
And you've created this open communication as they're learning more stuff, whether you're teaching it or they're hearing it. And any more thoughts on that? Because I think that's very, very helpful.
Look, I think the church has recently done a fantastic job of the same thing. They said, look, let's be adults here. We realize that people kind of go through faith stages, right? They, like all of us, you know, as we grow up, we believe our parents are perfect, right? We believe that people are perfect. I mean, that's just part of the human experience. And as we get older, we realize it's far from the case. But, you know, the church has done a great job of just saying, okay, now let's engage with this stuff, right? Let's be honest and open, right? And have a dialogue about it. My ward is fantastic, the ward I'm in now. They had a 2-hour long, essentially fireside on polygamy.
Really?
They brought in the young men and young women who I teach. And to me, that is a mature way of saying, we respect you. We love you. This is part of who we are. We know it can be shameful. We know it can be complicated, but we respect and love you enough to say, let's all deal with it together. And the same goes for my children, right? Is I respect you enough, I love you enough to just start having conversations about these things. Now, I know it's really hard, right? Because it's like you can have feelings about it that aren't like, oh, no big deal feelings, and you can pass that on to your children, right? But part of it is the work of a lifetime of really trying to work through these complicated issues so that your children see that your faith is multidimensional. Because they're certainly going to encounter challenges and difficulties. And if you have a dialogue with them around that from the get-go, they're more likely going to talk to you. They're not going to, you know, there's plenty of voices that will help shape your journey. But having a parent's voice and a child knowing that your parent knows how to deal with complicated, challenging things and still feel connected to the gospel, still model the behavior of the Savior, I mean, that I think is the ideal of where we want to be. Now, not that I'm there by any means, but that's the direction we're trying to go, my wife and I as parents.
Yeah, I really like that. How do you handle really close friends who leave? How does that affect you, and how does that friendship remain intact?
It's so hard. I mean, let's be honest, right? It's we're a people. We're a tribe in many ways, and so that makes it all the more complicated, right? It's not. It impacts me deeply. You know, I've had friends who have left, good friends. And to be honest, it hurts, you know, because I feel like these, my friends in this case and people who do leave, and I understand for some people, they can't do it for various reasons. And I'm sympathetic to that. But for friends who leave, I feel like we're worse off without them. Because here are people who are great, noble souls who have wrestled, you know, with God and with themselves. We can learn a lot from that. I mean, how much do we learn from people who really go to the mat with trying to figure out who they are? I mean, we can learn a lot. We need people like that. But it can be threatening it can be threatening to sit down with a friend and have a conversation where they're essentially telling you everything that you believe that I used to believe, you know, 2 years ago, 10 mm-hmm. minutes ago, 5 years ago, whatever, is complete hogwash. That can be hard.
Mm-hmm.
But my sense is that if the friendship is a friendship, that you can still have a connection with them as a human being, right? And there can be mutual learning there. Maybe the person who's, maybe they need to be pressure tested by me and vice versa. Maybe I need to be kind of woken up out of my slumber a little bit and be questioned. Maybe I've taken for granted the faith. And so no doubt it is incredibly hard. It's very sad. But to me, it makes it all the more important for us to really try as best we can to keep our arms around these people, to show them that our love is deeper than, this is hard, but it's deeper than even their spiritual commitments, where they go to church on Sunday, whether they do or they don't go to church on Sunday, that our love is deeper than those things. And that's the challenge of a lifetime, but I think that's the challenge that we need to take up if we're serious about being like the person the person whose name's on the building. I think we got to go with them the second mile and the third mile and the fourth mile. We got to walk with them.
I really like that. Does it scare you when you see a close friend leave that's going to happen to you? Or do you feel like at this point you're stable and that's not going to happen to you?
That's a good question. You know,
I don't know if stable is the right word.
No.
Because I don't want to
infer
that people that leave are unstable.
No, absolutely not. I think it makes you, like I was saying earlier, it makes you immediately reflect back on yourself and say, my goodness, where am I? Is that within me to say, you know, enough's enough, or I'm not really, don't really believe this anymore? It definitely makes one self-reflective. And for me, what matters is not necessarily looking down the road and saying, will I stay or will I go? It's what am I doing now to connect with God, to live like Christ?
That's cool.
And to embody that. I mean, it's about what happens now.
That's really cool.
Like, why worry about,
I can do that,
the future? I can do this minute.
I can do that.
I can do today. And let you know, like the Savior, you know, worry about today. Like, take no thought for tomorrow. Like, let's deal with my walk with God and my engagement with my faith today. Let's model how I want to be now, and let God take care of the rest.
Would you, if you could go back and not have these 3 or 4 years and just somehow never have experienced them, would you go back and somehow not have that experience? I'm sure in the time it may be a different answer, but
no one I don't think that anyone wants to be uncomfortable. No one, it's so easy to kind of cruise along and kind of be at the surface of who you are and the surface of your faith. That's easy. I mean, that's, who doesn't want that, right? So in a sense, it'd be great to just skate over that. But then I would never have become who I am. And you know, look, I again, this is in hindsight, right? But I think those who have walked this journey, right, they will continue to walk the journey, they kind of see it as I am who I am because of this. And so it's easy to do that in retrospect, but if you can find that in the midst of the fire, right? If you can find that purpose, if you can find that meaning, if you can hold to something like that.
In the midst of the fire.
Yeah.
In that dark night.
In that dark night, then that ray of hope can, I think, transform it, right? It can make of it a soul making experience, right? And so I mean, that's kind of my perspective. Again, does anyone want to have terrible emotional, intellectual, social, whatever challenges happen to them? Absolutely not. No one wants that. No one seeks that, right? But life, it finds you. And so what are you going to do with that? I mean, that's the question. That's the question life asks, right? That's the question these experiences ask of you.
I like that because it just is so full of hope. And if there's our listeners that are in this, you know, this dark night or the other terms we've used, I think Jake's story, I hope, gives you hope that this experience is for your good on the other side, where Jake is on the other side, that this gives Jake great perspective. I look at your ability to be a better father and a better husband because of this experience. Sounds like you're working in the young men's program right now in your ward, and your wife is working also in the ward, and it seems like your ability then to connect and help because of these life experiences is increased, and being real and vulnerable and sort of be able to go where people go, can need to go, because you've had to wrestle so much. And so I would call those wonderful Christ-like attributes and gifts.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what you learn, and this is a learning every day, is that, my gosh, the Savior was with those people who, if you want to find the Savior, again, he's my sense of where he is, where I've found him is in the difficult places.
That's great.
With the difficult people, so.
We're kind of coming to the end, sure. Jake. Any last thoughts? You know, Jake and I started with a prayer. We hope that there's been a good spirit here for our listeners, and that thoughts and ideas are coming into your mind for your own life or your ability to help other lives. But Jake, any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I would say that there's, hopefully life's long. Hopefully. And as such, that, you know, the challenge is to live in the present, to do today, right? Like we talked about, to live in the now, right? To do today in the midst of your struggles, right? But at the same time, be able to zoom out 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, and say, who is that person? Who is Jake at 85, hopefully? And how does that vision of who I want to be, how is that impacting the choices that I am making now, the life that I'm living now, the openness and the vulnerability and the desire to connect with others and God. I mean, that kind of zoom in and zoom out on your life is something that I would hope that people, parents, would think about as we go through faith challenges together, is that people can change. Life is long, and time and God can bring things into new forms and new, you know, experiences for people in a way that we can't conceive at this present time, of like being in the fire, right? And so having that connection to the present, but being able to kind of, you know, push the trajectory of your imagination of who you want to be out into the future is a really important thing to do in the midst of these dark nights. So that's what I'd say. And I'd also say, find people who you can trust and love and who will listen, and have all the hope in the world that God knows you and will find you in the midst of your struggles. I've certainly felt that. And I know that if you're open, that you will feel those divine tentacles reaching out and grabbing you in the midst of your struggle and you bringing you home.
That's great. Any thoughts for LGBTQ brothers and sisters? We haven't talked about that at all. Yeah. We're doing some podcasts. Yeah. Any just thoughts for our friends?
You're needed, deeply needed in the church. I think that those that, you know, are LGBTQ are the Lord's way of taking us to a higher spiritual and a loving plane. You know, that I talked about earlier where I read that scripture from Isaiah 14 about the Savior being a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And I imagine, you know, those who I have known that are LGBTQ, I know particularly for those in the church, they are filled with sorrow and acquainted with grief. And in many ways, their connection with, you know, their fellowship of the sufferings of Christ is deeper than ours in many ways. And we have much to learn from them. And I think that it's our Jericho Road. That the question that's asked of us, are we going to be the Good Samaritan or not? And they've fell among thieves in many instances. And it's, you know, the question of our discipleship in a lifetime to say, are we going to walk on the other side? Or are we going to take them on our backs? Or are we going to help them? And they're needed, loved, and can teach us much that we certainly don't yet know.
That's beautiful, Jake. Yeah. The visual of that is just wonderful. I love the way you get very tender for people that have a harder road.
Yeah.
That we've talked about tonight. So thank you, Jake Watts, for joining us.
Thank you.
Great podcast, great insights. I'm spiritually fed. And when I meet people younger than me, I just full of hope, you know. So I'm so glad you're on the podcast and glad to count you as a friend. And thank you for joining us on another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love.